Sorry, it took a little bit longer. Wow, there's a lot of people here. My name's Joseph. I'll be talking to you about extreme programming. I've worked for a number of years with this guy named Kent Beck, who invented the thing, and I'm responsible for a couple of the practices that are in there. So it's not all my fault, but some of it is. Just my first question, who was here yesterday at my talk about SmallScript? Okay, there's not that many, which means I can use the same jokes again. Well, that's the most important thing. So back by popular request, my next slide will show this picture. I flew up from Switzerland yesterday, and when I got off, I noticed some disturbance, some turbulence in the plane, and when we got off, I took a picture of what was up on the front of the plane. Okay. The basic idea behind extreme programming, I put it this way. What would you do different if you had to develop software for somebody and they could only afford to pay you for one day? Especially if you knew that if you gave them something at the end of that day and they could earn money with it, they can pay you for another day. What would you do different? Now, talking to normal audiences, okay, what's a normal audience? When I talk about this at Microsoft or IBM or stuff, that's a different type of audience than here. I might be sort of preaching to the choir right now. What would you do different if, you know, your customer couldn't really afford to pay you and you only got paid if you gave him something that he can earn money with? It's a sort of rhetorical question. You do only the stuff that would bring your customer a benefit. And you'd concentrate on doing as much of that as possible and getting rid of all this stuff that we hate to do anyway, which is stuff like documentation and analysis and design. Okay, that's sort of what people think extreme programming is. Essentially, it's concentrating on doing the things that will get your customer's project up and working quickly and getting you your money now rather than later. Is there anybody here who's tried to do this stuff already?
Sort of.
Okay, well, sort of is better than not doing it. Is that, if you're here, is there anybody here who thinks that all this stuff is a bunch of crap? Good. Have a beer afterwards to find out if I've changed your mind or not. Hold it. There are two types of XPs right now. I do not mean Bill Gates' new operating system. Extreme programming is a way to develop software which is designed for bigger projects. Let's say medium-sized projects. They haven't really proved it to be useful on projects with 100 software developers, but projects that have 100 software developers have their own problems anyway, and nothing like extreme programming or anything else is going to help these problems. I believe you can do extreme programming quite well on very small projects. I believe there's a bunch of stuff which is really useful and some stuff which you can throw away. And I'd like to just go through and present the basic ideas behind it and just point out stuff that I think is really useful and stuff that if you're going to start out and try it out, stuff you can leave away and stuff you might be able to concentrate on. So getting back to this quote, what you would do differently is concentrate on doing the stuff that brings your customer the money. Now, in most cases, if you're developing software for a customer, you can reckon with him being able to pay you for 2 weeks or so. If your customer can't even afford to pay you for 2 weeks, I'd start looking for another customer. But in normal case, a customer can pay you for about 2 weeks. So what you start doing is saying, okay, I'll give you 2 weeks worth of work. What can I bring you in 2 weeks which will really help you? And meet him in 2 weeks and bring him that. You only promise what you can deliver and you deliver what you promise. And that's a lot different than the vaporware, which a lot of companies, including Microsoft and IBM and Sun and whoever, are doing right now. We only promise what we know we can deliver, and we deliver what we promise. And what this does is it helps build up this situation of trust. Okay? Because what happens is that how many of you have had to start to build a software product for customers who really didn't know what they wanted? Right? Okay. So what happens is the customers in the beginning really don't know what they want, let's be honest about it. They're not quite sure. So what they do is they start, you know, in commercial software development, they start writing these big specifications which are notable for having what we call dust factor. Dust factor means when you whack them on a table, how much dust does it raise from the table? And it's amazing that with all the words that they use, that they never really tell you what they want. There's a reason behind this. It's because they don't know what they want, but they're trying to figure out a way to get you in the corner where they can say, well, that wasn't what we wanted. Now we want you to do something else. And which is why, you know, how many 80% of commercial software projects never go into release? I've been working developing software commercially for over 13 years now, and sort of worried now I'm in the 13th year. In 13 years, I've had a perfect track record of software that I deliver on time and on budget is the worst case scenario. I normally deliver a couple weeks to a month before time and normally below budget. And it took me a while to figure out what I was doing, and that was about 92 or so when I met Kent Beck and started working with him on stuff that essentially became extreme programming. It is possible to do this if you make sure you don't open your mouth up too much and promise too much. The worst thing you can do when you develop software is say, well, the customer says, I don't know what I want. You say, well, there's all these cool things you can do. Never tell the customer that, because once you tell them that, you're stuck. You're going to have to do it. So just sit back and let the customer, you have to learn to pull this stuff out from the customer. Another big problem developing software is that the longer it takes to develop software, the more danger it is that when you finally get it out, the customer finds out he doesn't need it, or the market finds out they don't need it, because somebody else has brought something else out in the meantime. And that's a real big danger. And so what we try to do is say, okay, let's take 2 weeks and let's set a milestone after 2 weeks. Look at this with the customer. Is this what you want? If it is, then okay, let's go along in this direction. If it isn't what they want, well, you haven't wasted that much time. It's a lot easier to make small changes. Software development is a system of like driving down the Autobahn where you don't just say, well, I'm going to go to Hamburg, so I get on the Autobahn in this direction and just put my foot on the gas. You're constantly changing. You're constantly making little corrections. And if you're able to develop software in a way that lets you just make little corrections, you'll get where you're going a lot faster than if you just point and just close your eyes and just keep driving. If you don't crash, the chances are big that you'll crash. But if you don't crash, you'll probably end up going off the wrong exit anyway. And then it's going to take a long time to double back. So, yeah, blah, 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 spend money. Now, there's this funny thing about spending money. I like to spend money. I like to earn money, too. But it took me a long time back when I was a software developer to learn how to deal with the financial aspect. Now I have my own company, and I really have to deal with it. But the thing I've learned is that the longer you have to wait to get your money, the less likely it is you'll get your money. And if you finally get your money, the less this money will be worth. Okay? So we have one guiding factor here, which is get your money as quickly as possible. Get some revenue in as quickly as possible for you and also for your customer. The other one is the reverse of this. The longer it takes before you have to pay money, the less likely it is you'll have to pay it. And, according to the calculations from net present value, the less you'll have to pay. So what we want to try to do is get a revenue stream coming in off our software as quickly as possible while paying as little as possible and paying that incrementally. So this is the way we start working on developing software. Let's give the customer stuff which will get revenue, get something in that he can use as quickly as possible, with him just developing and giving his wishes just piece by piece. There's another thing I keep saying about getting revenue in from the customer as quickly as possible. Giving the customer, let's call it giving the customer something he needs, because a lot of times we can just look at, if you give the customer the chance to find out what he really wants in his software, you've given him something he needs, right? So if you spend 2 weeks just working on something that the customer can look at and find out, well, I really didn't want this, you've earned money on that, because you haven't wasted money working a longer time on something that the customer doesn't need. Yeah, there's a question back there.
I think that a lot of people will be shaking their heads about spending money for writing software, because I think a lot of free software authors are here in that room. But I think that policymakers' money are totally applicable to free software too. And if you have, say, a weekend for working on your favorite project, you want to get the customer on the software out there as much benefit as possible in order to get more users, for a user base needs for a development base, more success for your free software project.
Yeah. Did you understand that, or should we repeat this? I think there's a couple good statements here. What I said was that extreme programming is normally used in connection with developing commercial software, and there's a lot of people in here who don't develop commercially, develop free software in their free time, and I've gotten to the point now myself where I don't have that much free time. And, you know, being in a relationship, I don't have that much free time that I can spend developing software by myself. So I like to make the time that I use developing software, use it as effectively as intensively as possible. And which is why I'm going to skip through a lot of these slides. I said I just wanted to give you a broad overview and then look at some of the points which you know, if you're just working by yourself developing software, which might help you. I think for a lot of people it would be quite difficult to apply everything from this methodology, but there are some things which are good. Let's jump over. Okay, we talked about that. It's calculations. Now, this is a cool slide. If there's one slide I like in this presentation, it's this one. And this is something that customers never understand. The golden rule is you have four variables: resources, time, quality, scope. Choose three. Most people think they can have all these things under control. What happens is, what they don't see is, what sucks is normally the quality of the software. Software gets delivered late and the quality gets a lot worse. So what you have to do is realize that you can only choose three of these, make three your priority, and the fourth is always going to be a function of the first three. Now, how does this work? Give you an example to take along to your customers, whoever they may be. In my other life, when I'm not developing software, I do a lot of music. I used to play professionally a lot. I play not that often anymore, but I like working with young bands. And I had this problem a couple months ago. I had this young rock band I help occasionally, and they're doing a concert on New Year's now. And why do teenagers play rock music? To get girls. The ladies in the audience, please overhear this. So what they want to do is they want to get up on stage and go really hard rock. And do it, you know, good stuff to impress the girls. That's why I started playing guitar. but, okay, they have this gig now next week, and it was back in September, and, you know, they have all these songs they want to play. They want to play their whole repertoire, and they want to be good, and they practice once a week, and it's just not working out. So, how do I go about dealing with this? I can either go in and say, well, you have to do this, this, and this. And even though they accept me, they'll listen to me, they're not going to put up with some old guy who has less hair than all of them telling them how they have to practice stuff. What you have to do is just what I did, I presented them with their alternatives and said, choose three of these and see what happens. Now, what you can do is you can say, hold it, I got this magical zapper from a conference I did, and this is my authentic Star Wars lightsaber. Ta-da! Okay. You can say, you want to play on New Year's. You want to play all these pieces well. Right? Play on New Year's, play all these pieces well. You've chosen three. Resources is function three. What does that mean? You want to play all this stuff well next week, you're going to have to practice more than once a week. Right? Okay, you want to play all these pieces well and only practice once a week? Never going to make it on New Year's. What's happening now is you want to play all these pieces on New Year's practicing once a week? That sucks. So what I told them to do, and this is what I tell people to do when developing software, you want to play a good concert on New Year's, get it out on time, practicing once a week, play less pieces. And there's a trick to this in the music, and they call that the guitar solo. Right? It's an even better one. They call it the drum solo. So I got them to find a way that they can really be happy playing. They'll play less pieces. They'll just do longer solos. They're actually doing one of these 1970s drum solos where everybody else takes off their instrument and goes off the stage. And everybody's really happy. The drummer can show off and stuff. They're totally happy. The people who are going to be listening are happy because the music's not crap. And this is a way to develop software. Now, people will believe you more if you get stuff out on time and if the stuff is good. Okay, there might be a little bit less of it. But your resources are fixed. You only have so much time to be able to work on this stuff, especially if you're only working in your free time. Hey, folks, free time is quite a valuable asset. Time is the most valuable thing we have, and the older I get, the more I start recognizing that I've wasted a lot of time doing stupid things when I was young. And if you want to hear about the stupid things I did when I was young, we can talk later about that. Okay, that's a good slide. Let's forget that. Change. So, extreme programming talks a lot about being based on four basic principles. Communication, being able to talk to each other honestly, means a customer being able to say, well, I don't know what I want. And you as a developer saying, well, if you don't know what you want, I'm not going to be able to program it for you. And also be able to tell the customer that, well, that stuff that you want, we're not going to be able to do it in time. Or we've run into a problem. And learn to talk honestly with each other. Making simplicity, making things as simple as possible but not simpler. And this is really difficult. When you get into commercial software development, there's all these people who have like brains as big as a planet, and they're paid a lot for being able to think into the future. And that's part of their, you know, their market value. That's what they get paid for, is being able to think in the future, look at all the eventualities, and program for that. Well, as it turns out, that it doesn't really work like that. You can get by without having a program for stuff that might happen by concentrating on the stuff you need right now. Because the way we build software, most of the times, if you're going to need it later, you can build it later. As long as you're careful about what you're building now, it's not going to cost you much more to build it later than it is to build it now. And right now, you're spending your time and your resources on building something which the customer really needs now. And also, I've just had the experience that when I've tried to build things for later, it's never turned out the way that I thought at that time. Because in the meantime, the market has changed, my customers changed, I've learned more, and I've always found out I could just throw that stuff away and start from the beginning and get where I wanted to go a lot quicker than if I had tried to look a year ahead and build it before. Feedback is really important to find out from your customer if you're giving him that what you want, to find out from your code if it's doing that what you want. This gets us to one of the main points, which is writing tests and running tests. And then courage. If you start running tests, if you're able to talk to people, keeping your stuff simple, you have a really nice moving machine. You can try to do a lot of crazy things with it, which will help you write software even better and better, and it'll snowball into a really good product.
Oh, Matt.
So, the basics. Listening, testing, coding, refactoring. That's all there is to software. And anybody tells you something else is trying to sell you something, and probably an expensive software tool. I firmly believe in this. You have to listen so you know what you're supposed to do. You have to write a test. Now, we believe in writing tests before we write software. Now, this is sort of one of these funky type of things. But writing a test before you write software is a very scientific way of doing it. You say, I have this hypothesis that it should run like this, and I'll test this hypothesis, and of course it won't work. But at least you know that it doesn't work, and when you start writing software just to pass this test, you know exactly when it does work. And when it works, that's the time when you can stop writing software. You don't have to write anymore. You know you wrote exactly what you need to pass this test. And then what you do is you refactor, you clean up your code so that you can keep on building on it, so that you don't end up painting yourself into a corner that you can't get out of. So, one night, Kent Beck and I sat, we used to share an apartment down in Munich when we were working on this project, and unfortunately it was right around the corner from the Hofbräuhaus. So we had a number of late evening talks. And one of them, I woke up the next morning and found that we had scribbled this on a napkin, and I had to decipher it. These are the 12 interlocking principles of extreme programming. I always hate these lists of, you know, the top 10 list, or you know, the 6 things I like about German television, or you know, the top 12 or something. I wish this list was some you know, 17 or some prime number, but it happens to be 12. And a lot of people have tried and failed to sort out this list so that none of the lines cross. But I've decided I can't work with it like this, so I've started concentrating on doing things like this. And I hope you can read this in the back. There are 4 circles here. And what I think is really important to give to you right now is the stuff that's in this inner circle. There are 3 principles: testing, refactoring, and pair programming. The further you get out, the more this gets away from what you're doing as software development. This is the stuff that you do as a developer. The next loop is a bunch of stuff that a group of developers do by themselves or do together. The next loop is a bunch of stuff that a whole development team does, and the outer loop is a bunch of stuff that you have to deal with management and customers and all these people who bother you. So, let's look at these principles. Testing. We write our tests and they stay at 100%, and this is very important. But let's get to the second thing. Okay, we write tests first. This is really strange to be able to write a test and let it run before you write software code. It's one of the strangest things. I really had a problem learning how to do this, but try it. Just try it. Try to write a test. Essentially, your test is describing what you think this code should be doing. And you let the test run, and of course it crashes because your code ain't doing nothing yet. Sorry, a question.
Sorry, I'm getting things wrong here, but didn't you say that specification wasn't in the whole concept? Write your test first, go then the test software is specification.
Okay. What I'm doing now is trying to dump a lot of information in a short time. There's a bunch of stuff which comes out in the outer circle of the stuff that you deal with your customers with, which is covered by the planning game and the simple design and stuff like that, which is where you get the input for what you're supposed to be doing for the customer. And that's where your specification, your analysis, and your design comes in. Right now we're concentrating just on the task of writing a piece of software. Okay? Yeah. Okay, write the test first. Put together your scientific hypothesis. and validate it. And of course it won't work. This hurts in the beginning, because we like to write software that runs and software that passes tests. Well, this hurt is good. This hurt is the motor that pushes us to get the code running as quickly as possible, and also to only write the code that we need. If you don't have any tests, well, then you're quite happy writing all this other interesting code or these algorithms that you always wanted to try out, which are always somehow written in one page of pseudocode on a page of CT or one of these other computer magazines. I used to write software like that too. Oh, this is cool. I got to try this out. You don't have time to do that. It's wasting your time a lot of times. Concentrate on the stuff that you really need to deliver, and you know exactly when you're finished. Tests are... I describe software development as being a way of driving your car down the autobahn. Tests are your eyes. If you don't have your eyes open, you're going to crash. If you don't have your tests always there and always running, your development's going to crash. And it's stupid to say, well, the tests ran once, why should I, of course they ran once. It's like saying, okay, well, I have to go to Hamburg, I'm pointed in that direction, I can close my eyes. You're going to run into problems. Keep the tests, keep them always running. When you get really extreme, you don't write any code unless you have a test which crashes. And that's a hell of a lot of discipline. I'm not able to do that by myself. Beck's not able to do that by himself. Most XP people I know aren't able to do that by themselves, which is why we do something called pair programming. It's a way of discipline. Let's see, how much time do I have? I can't read this. Somebody know what time is this? Another 17 minutes. Okay, there's a talk in here at 7 o'clock, and I'm going to break sort of around 7 o'clock, even though we're probably not finished yet. Anybody else who has questions and stuff, we'll take that discussion out or down to a restaurant or someplace I can drink a beer or something like that. Good. Refactoring. Oh, man. Refactoring is good. It's important. I'm not going to talk about it right now. It's worth it looking into it. There's a guy named Martin Fowler who wrote a real good book about refactoring. Pair programming is a strange concept for people who spend late nights and weekends locked up in a closet by themselves hacking. But pair programming is really fun. It's also difficult to do in a company environment where people say, well, why are you people sitting together? If I separated you, you can do twice as much work. I'm losing money putting people together. Well, there's this really cool lady named Lori Williams at the University of North Carolina who's done a bunch of tests and studies and written papers about pair programming, who's come to notice the fact that, okay, the boss says, you guys should split up there. Don't sit there together. You're wasting your time. They think that one person working alone works at 100%. This is not the case. How many of you hack code for a living? Okay, there's a bunch of you. How many of you work an 8-hour day and spend 8 hours a day hacking code? Boy, I'd like to hire you. Can we talk afterwards? As it turns out, statistics have shown that that most people don't work at 100%. They work at about 40% once they, take off time for going to the bathroom, take off time for phone calls, for email, for playing Quake, for surfing. Okay? It's just a mistake to think that a person working alone is working at 100%. That's what it comes down to. Two people working together, it turns out their productivity comes up to about 66%, because they tend to take their breaks together and stuff like that. So I'm just doing a really funky calculation here, but if two people working alone work at 40%, that comes to 80% of some mythological quantity. 66% about that isn't too bad. It's about 15% less effective than two people working alone. But what has shown up is that the quality of the code is a lot better. Yep, pairs take, on the average, 15% more time to do a product. But on a project which Laurie Williams did, where working 1,000 hours to get code done, the people working in pairs work 15% longer, but getting the bugs out afterwards for the people who did the code by themselves took over 2,500 more hours, where the code that the pairs had done was essentially bug-free. Now, there is something to be said here. Yeah, people working alone work faster, but their code is not better. If you want to get your code better, working alone or working in a pair, start trying to write your tests first. That's the single best thing. If you take two things from this talk, take that. The one with the four variables and the rock band and about how to pick up chicks, that's always a good one to bring. And the one about writing the tests first. Okay? If you take two things along, take those two things along. Okay, next circle here. I notice these colors we'll have to redo. Integrating coding standards and collective code ownership. This is a really funky thing. When a lot of people work on software, people tend to get stingy about my software. Oh, sorry, there was a question back there. No. Okay. You know, it's my code and nobody's going to touch that code. And don't put your stinking fingers on that. This is dangerous for a customer. Yeah. Let me turn this around. Yes, it does matter, but it matters in the way that it can be a danger, a risk to a company. In any company, there are people who are really good at certain things. But if that person who's good at it is the only one who understands the code, we have something which we call the truck factor. The truck factor is how many programmers can get hit by a truck without the project crashing. And if the truck factor happens to be one, then you're up a creek. And this is the reason why we say that it's good to work in pairs so that at least somebody else can cover, as long as the person who's the expert there is under the truck someplace else. You know, that's true that, you know, a good programmer, depending on the language that you're working in, plays a role too. But a good programmer can be more than 10 times as effective as a bad programmer is. Yeah. Where it turns out, if you get programmers working good like this, you need less of them. So it's a lot easier to get the bad ones out too. If you have the resources, the money and stuff, you can have the time to help teach the programmers who aren't that good and get them up to speed. I believe in people having specialty fields, stuff they do better, stuff they like to do better. It's just dangerous if they're the only one doing it because, we have to, reboot the server and Bob's the only one who has a password and he's in Malaysia right now and he might be back next week, but we can't reach him. This is the danger that we try to address here. I know companies who've had an expert consultant come in to do some bit of software for them in an XP way. They'll get the consultant and they'll have two people sit next to him and bug him and bother him and ask all kind of questions, and once the consultant's done, they'll throw away all the software he's written and let these two people write it again. They have the test there, so they'll know when the software works. If these two people aren't able to write the software, they don't pay the consultant. Think of that. There's also, I work a lot in Germany and Switzerland and stuff. I've seen consultants, external, people hold companies hostage. They'll write code where they're the expert, nobody else understands it, and then they'll leave the company and get themselves hired on at twice the rate as a consultant. Software development, keeping us all alive and being able to eat food means balancing both sides. It means balancing the consultant and the programmer side and also balancing the side for the company. Because if the company can't afford to pay these people, the company's going to go bankrupt, and a lot of other people will be hurt there too. So it's just a matter of juggling stuff there.
Doesn't that depend on how you define zip code?
I'm sorry. Does it depend on how you define good code? We get to a couple slides coming up here. We'll address that. But there is there's a lot of issues about quality of good code, and I think we could spend the whole evening talking about what's good code and what isn't. There's always this saying that, especially in object-oriented languages, where people say, you know, you should be able to write reusable code. Make sure your code's reusable. I keep telling people, write reuseful code. Write code that's good enough that that people will want to use it again. Then take a look at it. Getting to maintainable code and getting the time running down here. Continuous integration. Coding standards. Man, don't you hate this? This is the subject of religious wars. Do you put the opening bracket on the same line, or do you take it down a line, and do you indent or not? Whichever way you express it, somebody's going to disagree. So the big thing to do with coding standards is get them in place. As long as you're not working alone, you need coding standards. And get something that you agree on, but get something which tends to be, which is standard in the community. There are books out of coding standards. There's Plum and Sachs stuff for C and C++. There's Elements of Java Style. There's Best Small Talk Patterns from Beck. There's, for every language, there's a standard way of writing stuff. Something I said in my talk yesterday about SmallScript. Every language has its vocabulary and its grammar. It has its idioms and it has its polite way of saying things. And I think we should learn to say things in a polite way so that other people can understand us. And I'm a firm believer in creative self-expression of, expressing your creative nature. But do you have to do it through white space? Think about it. You know, there's other ways to express yourself than having to format code differently. Oh, man. Okay. The rest of these slides just go on talking about things which are outside of the real thing, and that's the end. So what I'd like to do is just, ask if there are any more questions we can address here. I really want to be considerate for my speaker who's coming afterwards. Yeah? What are the main weaknesses I see in extreme programming? One weakness is that it hasn't been communicated that properly. It's difficult to find the real good information on it. There's this little white book from Beck, and that's totally outdated. That was the way XP was back in 98. It's changed a lot since then. The thing is, it needs a lot of discipline. It really needs a lot of discipline to write your tests first, to make sure you keep refactoring, to keep sure you program in pairs, to make sure you talk to your customer and everything. And if you don't keep doing this, you're going to get it's the worst thing you could possibly do for your code, if you don't have the discipline. Yeah, next question.
Isn't writing all these tests sometimes very expensive, or maybe even complicated to really do it? I mean, I'm just thinking of, maybe it's not the typical company situation, but yeah. If you buy security software and you want to test if some computer somewhere in the network does something in response to what you do, how do you simulate that with a test environment that's really involved?
Okay, there are two questions here. One is, doesn't it cost too much time to write tests? And the other one is, how do you simulate stuff in a distributed environment? Let's do the second one first. The second one, go to www.mockobjects.com and take a look there. There's a bunch of stuff that Tim McKinnon and Steve Freeman did with mock objects to simulate stuff on a distributed system. The second one is, doesn't take a lot of time to write tests. Yes, it does, and that's why you have to learn. I think learning to write tests is the most difficult part of XP for me. How do you write a test that really expresses what you need to know? I think it's a waste of time to write a test that say, okay, foo is new object, and say, you know, assert true, foo class is object. That's stupid. That doesn't tell me anything I didn't know before. So how do I write tests which really help me? I only write tests which fail. If I write a test that I know beforehand that it'll pass, according to information theory, I'm not gaining any new information. It's a moot point to write this test. And there's a bunch of stuff. Object creation, unless you have a bunch of stuff in the constructor or creation protocol. Accessors, all that stuff. Hey, we know that works. You don't write tests for that. People tend to write tests to the external protocols or external interfaces of objects. It's a very difficult thing to do. I've seen companies belly up where they say, well, we don't have any time to write tests anymore because they're trying to test every single method or every single message sent. You have to really practice a lot to learn how much can I test in how little test code as possible. And the other one, mockobjects.com. Okay, another question?
So to take up your original example, you have 2 weeks time and until your customer,
yeah.
How long would you spend on writing the test and how long on writing the program?
Okay, this is a standard question. How much of your time do you spend writing tests? How much of your time do you spend writing code? I've never really analyzed that, but somehow I get the feeling that I spend about a third of my time on the tests and two-thirds on the code. Sometimes it may be more, sometimes it may be less. Things happen in projects, like really funky things happen. In the beginning, you write a test that doesn't work. You write a lot of tests that don't run until you get code. But if you're working together with a bunch of people, all working on different aspects, time will happen when you write a test and you'll run it and it'll work and you don't know why. It turns out somebody else who was working on another part of the system wrote code for his functionality, which just happens to cover yours. Hey, that's great. Go drink a beer. You don't even have to write any code. Your test works already. But I think it comes down to someplace between half and half and maybe a third test and two-thirds writing code. Okay, there's one last question.
How new is XP?
How new is XP? It's old. There's a bunch of stuff which has been done for decades. All it is it's a bunch of... Pardon?
Can you give some examples of what areas?
Yeah. No, there's just some basic ideas about writing stuff with rapid feedback and, you know, small iterations and stuff. Beck said he got a lot of those ideas from his dad, who wrote embedded stuff in assembler back, you know, 30 years ago. And a lot of it's just good practice, just simple ideas which just happen when you put them together, happen to work well together. And that's all it is. It's not really extreme. What's extreme is trying to keep the discipline up, to keep your code clean and only write what you really need. And that's the problem, keeping it simple, and only writing the stuff that you need and writing your tests first. Okay, I see there's a bunch of people back here. I don't know who's waiting for the next talk or not. I'm going to be outside afterwards. You can grab me and ask me some other questions. I'd like to thank you a lot for coming in and listening, and try it. You might not like it, but at least give it a try. There might be one or two things here which you can use. And think about trying to write your tests first. Thanks a lot.